This is Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, A Revolutionary Crisis Opens in Pakistan. All rallies, all political gatherings are outlawed, stated Pakistani government spokesman Tariq Azim Khan. Security forces are deployed throughout Lahore and other cities. Many streets are barricaded and police with AK-47 assault weapons positioned in front of Lahore's markets, public gardens, and other sites. Two-time former Prime Minister and Pakistani People's Party leader Benazir Bhutto has been placed under house arrest for the second time in a week. She had planned to lead a 165-mile long march from Lahore to Islamabad to protest President Pervez Musharraf's declaration of martial rule. The home where she is staying has been heavily barricaded, and driveways of the upscale Lahore neighborhood turned into small police stations, with the streets lined with police roadblocks to prevent supporters from reaching her. 10,000 PPP members alone have been detained so far. Students in university, lawyers and labor leaders and leaders of opposition parties have been arrested and detained with no one knowing where they are. There are plans to try them for treason before military tribunals. But this hasn't stopped the protests. It is 10 days since General Musharraf suspended the Constitution, habeas corpus and other rights, fired Supreme Court justices, and declared emergency rule, suspending the broadcast of independent television and radio station and censoring the press. This was on the eve of a U.S.-brokered power-sharing plan between Musharraf and Bhutto. Recently, Benazir Bhutto came out with a startling statement, quote, "I am calling for General Musharraf to step down, to quit and leave. I could not serve as prime minister with General Musharraf as president." Today on Taking Aim, we have with us again Maqsood Alan, BBC correspondent in Islamabad. Ralph?
Yes, Maqsood, please fill us in now on the dynamics of the conflict now between the regime and a growing mass movement that Benazir Bhutto purports to speak for, even as the Asia Times and Washington Post and CNN and New York Times report. Bhutto is open to a power-sharing deal, and Bhutto is a master of public relations. This is the Washington Post. She's not going to overthrow her own apple cart, indicating that for all the attempts on the part of Bhutto to capture the dynamic of the mass movement, the door is open for her to share power with Musharraf. What would your assessment be about the present dynamic, what's unfolding today? How do you see this progressing, Maqsood?
Thanks for inviting me, Ralph. It's always good to speak to you and to your audiences.
Thank you.
Yes, there is a change. There is a change in Benazir Bhutto's demeanor. When she came in, she did not make it any secret that she had brokered some kind of a deal with the help of Washington, with the help of London. The deal, whatever we know of it, it kind of centered on Benazir Bhutto and General Musharraf sharing power. The idea floated by Washington and London was that General Musharraf, being the military man, the muscle man, he will provide the force, and Benazir Bhutto's liberalism will provide the antidote to the Islamic extremists. For some reason, this deal couldn't even go through for a few days, let alone a few months and years. When Benazir Bhutto arrived and she started meeting people and she started meeting her own party workers, and when she started confronting the civil society, she was constantly bombarded with the flog that, listen, you are the one party that at least stands for democracy, for liberalism. This man, General Musharraf here, he is a dictator. And recently what he has done, he has suspended constitution. Like you were just narrating what has happened in Pakistan over the last 10 days. How can you even sit with this man? She very gradually changed her stance. And it was only yesterday she came out and said, well, enough is enough, and I don't think I can work with this man anymore. Now, what has happened lately is, apparently, there was some kind of understanding between the two of them that when Benazir Bhutto comes back, she will be allowed contact with the masses. She's tried twice. She tried in Islamabad a few days ago, she was put under house arrest. Her workers were arrested, and she could not. She could not do the rally that she was planning to. Then 4 days later, she said she's going to have a march from Lahore to Islamabad. And like Maya was just saying, she was again put under house arrest. A few other leaders are under house arrest. Some of them who were free, they did take out a rally, and they are moving on the planned route of the rally. But it's not as big, and it doesn't have the leader at the front. Now, Benazir Bhutto does seem to have come clean of it, and she seems to have realized that she does not have a future, not even until elections, with General Musharraf.
Could you describe the rally that is taking place, the march?
Well, we are far away from it. It was supposed to end in Islamabad. I'm sitting in Islamabad now. There was supposed to start from Lahore, which is supposed to be the political capital of Pakistan, political in the sense, in the political workers' capital of the country. It's a very vibrant, very thriving kind of a city. And the idea was to take thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands with you, go all the way, keep adding up to the crowd. And by the time you end up in Islamabad, you have a huge, big crowd. And that would have been your intentions were going to be very, very clear. Listen, this is the support of masses I have. Now, deal or no deal, we're going to have to talk on equal footing rather than me being the junior partner. Well, that did not happen. The rally is still on. The last I heard from our own colleagues with the rally was there were about a couple of hundred cars on the roads, and then people are supposed to, they're expected to, join them as they move on the route of the rally.
Well, you know, Masood, we have to, I think, keep in mind that Benazir Bhutto, as the New York Times article, Bhutto's persona raises distrust. This is the 11th of November by Jane Perlez, describes the at least $1.5 billion of money that was stolen by her husband and herself, and the charges that are pending against her, with Musharraf has basically giving her an amnesty over. And indeed, the very Supreme Court justices, Justice Chaudhry and the Supreme Court justices who were dismissed by Musharraf were also justices that were not going to sanction another prime ministership for Benazir Bhutto. So she is very much dependent upon the arbitrary treatment of the justices and the lawyers and the courts. And the power-sharing deal is not only presumptively from Washington's perspective to contain the mass disaffection in Pakistan, but to create a civilian facade for basically the same type of rule.
Ralph, what you're referring to is the fact that the Pakistani constitution had been amended limiting the selection of prime minister to serving two terms, and Benazir Bhutto has already served two terms. So the constitution would have to be amended once again to allow her to serve as prime minister. Isn't that correct?
That's true, Maya. The idea, the so-called deal was that there will be sort of partners without power sharing until elections. After elections, People's Party was expected to win, you know, so many seats, and then when they get to the parliament, then Musharraf with his own party would make sure that that there is two-thirds majority that is required to change the constitution and have her fight for the prime ministership for the third term. Well, that doesn't seem to be happening right now. What's happening is that Benazir Bhutto herself is going through a metamorphosis of sorts, and where Ralph started, that she is not trustworthy. Well, she has changed her tact a number of times in the past. When she started off, when she started her campaign here in Pakistan, she arrived here to a wonderful start. She had a huge, big welcome in Karachi. That went very well, although towards the middle of it, in that huge, big rally, there were two bomb blasts, and more than 140 people were killed and hundreds injured. So, but she did have show of force before that tragedy happened. After that, she never ever mentioned anything about judiciary. She never talked about judiciary at all. All she would talk about was that I have promised to my people that I will not work with a military man, and that Musharraf will be a civilian when I share power with him. Well, not many people actually bought that, because General Musharraf, even if he resigns from his military job today, by law, he is not, he's not allowed to go for any elected post for 2 years. That's the law. So even if he takes off his uniform, as everyone keeps speculating when he's going to do that, for the next 2 years, he still cannot be in the politics. He cannot go for a public office. Now, it was only in Islamabad 3 days ago when she met the civil society in Islamabad. They told her point blank that if you do not demand the reinstatement of the Supreme Court as it stood on 2nd of November, well, we are not with you. Because we think you are only vying for your own power, for your own prime ministership, whereas what's important for us is we want the judiciary restored as it was before General Musharraf actually broke it down. It was only after meeting with the civil society in Islamabad that she drove to the judges' colony, which is where all the chief justices live. She was not allowed to go in, but there were some scuffles, and she made it a point. She stood there, and she made a speech saying, for the very first time, by the way, she mentioned in that speech, excuse me, that she wants the judiciary back to where it was on 2nd of November, and she said that for me, Justice Iftikhar Chaudhary is still the Chief Justice of Pakistan and not the other candidate who has been given the job by General Musharraf.
It's interesting because Masood, for all of this talk about the judiciary, as the New York Times article on November 9th put it, anger runs deep in Pakistanis. And the article describes how rich and poor, professionals and laborers, members of the security forces and civilians, all overwhelmingly oppose the emergency decree, rejecting it as a naked attempt by General Musharraf to bolster fading powers. People are not fools, said Mohammed Salim, a phone clerk in Islamabad. I do understand this is not to stop so-called Islamic militants. If I stood for election, said Jengahir Ahmed, a welder from Rawalpindi, I would win more seats than Musharraf. And then the article in the Times goes on to say, on people's minds is the economy, beset by spiraling prices. Of seven young men covered in grease, almost all had a junior high school education and make under $200 a month. Two had never attended school and were illiterate. They criticized the declaration. They cited how the economy is deepening in crisis. Quote, Mohammed Imran, a 24-year-old with a fifth-grade education, said the emergency has worsened and the most important reality of his life and everybody he knows is poverty. He was unaware and unconcerned about the debates between the parties. We lose every day, he said angrily. Gholam Murtaza, 24, a tailor in Islamabad, he echoed these sentiments, and the article is replete with description of, quote, the poor expressed deep cynicism about the prospect of change after decades of disappointment with both political and military leaders. Civilian government may be preferable, but neither has benefited them. Whoever comes and rules, it doesn't affect us, said Mohammed Nawaz, 51, a street vendor. None of these parties give us anything. None of them care about poor people.
And the Congressional Research Service, in its report to Congress, stated that illiteracy among women in Pakistan remains at 62%.
And that's the official figure, which no one among the civil society buys here, by the way. Yeah, please continue.
You think it's much larger?
Don't take it from me, but every non-governmental organization, every organization that works on the education sector will tell you that the government figures are hugely inflated, have always been so, and that the real literacy figures are somewhere near 35-40%.
For the population at large?
Yes, population at large. Women's education rate would be slightly lower than men's. And the economy, Ralph, what you were talking about, yes, that's. I think that goes without saying for any society, for any country, if you don't have two square meals on your table, well, things aren't right. You aren't going to feel good about anything. That's the bottom line. But other than that, people are angry for a number of other things with General Musharraf's rule in general and particularly after the emergency. I'll just give you a small example. Just yesterday in Islamabad, some school students, some 200 school students, and when I say school, it's not the American word school, which also means college and university. I mean school, like high school, until class 10th. There were some college students too, but mostly school students. There were 12 and 13-year-olds too. 200 of them, they took out a procession in Islamabad for what they said was for restoration of judiciary and against the emergency rule. They had their mouths taped, and it was supposed to be a silent demonstration. They were walking on the, not on the roads, they were walking on the grass along the road, and they were going from point A to point B for the demonstration. They were stopped by police. There were good about four trucks full of police. They were beaten up. They were dragged. We have eyewitnesses who saw 12 and 13-year-olds being dragged onto the roads, thrown into the trucks. They were taken to the police station, held there until their parents came, gave affidavits to them saying they won't be involved with anything like this ever again, and only then they were allowed to return home.
And now, speaking about affidavits, I read in the newspaper that students attending the university had to sign affidavits that they wouldn't be involved in political protests, that this has been going on for years, and that student unions have been banned for the past 20 years, creating...
You were just reading from a newspaper about people saying, you know, every government does the same, we have no hope. Well, that's what comes out of depoliticization of masses in general. People have no respect. They have, they don't have any hope, really, in any government, in military government, civilian government. I'm talking of masses in general. The only section of society which is vibrant at the moment, which is really coming out and doing something about it, is the civil society, which was generally expected to be quiet and to be away from trouble. These are the people who wouldn't want to spend even a day in jail. These are the people who don't want to be beaten up on the streets. These are the only people who are coming out and protesting on the streets. These are the people who are raising voices now. And it's because usually at this time a political party would go to the masses, talk to them, and make them come out to the street. This time, there is no political party that can do that. People's Party tried it and still trying, but apparently the government is coming down very hard on it and hasn't been able to. It hasn't succeeded in bringing out people. But civil society is protesting, and it's protesting very, very loudly and very effectively.
By civil society, I assume you mean the lawyers' associations and the human rights associations.
It's a very loose term, by which I mean the general people, but educated professionals, and that does include students. And I don't mean school students here. I mean university, college students. That includes lawyers. That includes professionals, even like me. Journalists are on the streets every day. Almost every day, journalists hold out a protest procession on one part of the city or the other. So Islamabad, whichever day you choose to come to Islamabad, there will be one or two or more processions in the city on a daily basis.
I'm going to read from the All Pakistan Trade Union Federation declaration. The All Pakistan Trade Union Federation, a national trade union center in Pakistan, having the affiliation of 240 trade unions of public and private sector industries, commercial institutions, the brick kiln workers, and general laborers are also part of the federation, struggling to eliminate child bonded labor and discrimination against workers and striving hard to uplift the working and living conditions of downtrodden society, facing the worst conditions, long working hours, low wages, no freedom of association, labor laws that prevent unionization and collective bargaining, very few implementation of labor laws, no freedom of association, the All Pakistan Trade Union Federation declaring a call for resistance to the emergency decree, the same for the Trade Union National Defense Campaign, their leaders arrested, the PTDUC members arrested in the struggle against the imposition of martial law by Musharraf as the topic of an article, brutally attacking lawyers, yes, but the Pakistan Trade Union Defense Campaign has been under siege as well. Indeed, Munir Ahmed, the president of the Qasur District Bar Association of the Lawyers, is a member of the PTUDC and who was arrested. Indeed, Aizaz Hassan, member of the National Assembly and president of the Supreme Court, joining him in arrest. Likhat Sahi, general secretary of the PTUDC, Farid Awan, the famous labor leader of Karachi, Irshad Shah, the executive member of Malir District, issuing an appeal to all comrades in all countries to support the struggle of working people in Pakistan against arbitrary rule. Chaudhry Munir, Asan Boon, a series of trade union leaders who have been disappearing, who are Farid Awan, subject to severe torture at the moment. So surely there is an unfolding working class struggle, not only that of the lawyers. And as Masood, the papers here have been describing, there is an explosion of awakening among students that has not occurred in over 20 years.
That's true, and not just the traditional student class. Now, you see, in Pakistan, there's been a very stark division. On one hand are the students from traditional schools, from local government schools, and on the other hand, there are these private, big public schools, which are very expensive, and only a very select few can send their kids to those schools. Well, surprise is this time that the spate of protests has come out of those elitist, the so-called elitist schools. It started in Lahore with LAMS, the Lahore University of Management Sciences. By the way, General Musharraf is the patron-in-chief of that institution. And then it spread to a number of other schools, colleges, universities. Same happened in Islamabad. It's happening in other cities. And it's a phenomenon that hasn't happened before. Well, earlier, and I'm talking 70s and 80s, when people did come out, they usually came out of universities. Most movements, they took root in universities. Even political parties, for their support, would always go to universities. This is the first time that private colleges, privately owned colleges, the so-called elitist places of education, these are the places where these protests are coming out from. And that is a very difficult sign for the government. They're not used to this kind of reaction. They know the traditional where the traditional resistance can be, and they are prepared for they have the traditional responses. This time, this is untraditional response, and they don't know what to do except keep picking up people and putting them in the jail. And by the way, I did a story lately about the condition of jails. All over Pakistan, 118% is the overcrowding figure for the country, and that was before this mass arrest started 10 days ago. So you can imagine the kind of situation people are forced to live in those jails.
And with the mass arrest, are these people disappeared?
Well, there are two kinds of people. There is the political activist who whose only crime is that he comes out or she comes out and raises slogans in the street. Well, they don't disappear. They just go to the jail, they spend a month, 2 months, 3 months, come out. There are those whose mere existence is a threat to the government. They are the people who disappear. Lately, well, not strictly talking about disappearance here, but talking about government's response, well, a number of political leaders have come out on the street. A number of people have tried to take out rallies. Some have been house arrested. Others have been taken to jails. But there's one leader who has been singled out for a treason charge. He did exactly the same thing that the other political leaders were doing. I'm sorry. Mr. Achakzai, he is a nationalist leader from Balochistan province. And Balochistan is where, by the way, part of the war on terror, the so-called war on terror is being fought. He came down to Karachi Press Club. He was with the Pakistani journalists in Karachi protesting against the imposition of emergency rule when everyone else was picked up and released or picked up and jailed for a few days. He was picked up and charged with treason. So a number of very dangerous things are happening here. People from Balochistan look at this case and say, oh, well, how come you treat all the other political leaders in one fashion and Baluchi leader in another fashion? Everyone else only gets a few days in jail or a few hours in police detention, whereas our leader gets charged with treason. So it's really spreading. I mean, what General Musharraf is trying to do with this country is it's probably already beyond him. It's already out of his hands by now.
That is very much the theme that has been expressed by a number of reports. The Emily Wax report in the Washington Post, Masood, for Pakistani students, a reawakening, we cannot just sit idle. As you described it, the accounting majors at the elite Lahore University of Management Sciences have rarely demonstrated against anything, preferring Punjabi pop music to protest songs. Cynicism about Pakistan's parade of autocratic and corrupt leaders had replaced civil disobedience. But now in computer labs and cafeterias and across the campus and across the country, students are making placards that read, "Democracy Now, Students Against Martial Law," as they prepare to demonstrate against emergency rule. They state that they are not going to continue to be depoliticized, with police lining the streets of Lahore on Sunday and a Bhutto rally blocked by authorities in Rawalpindi. They say they doubt the protests will end, even if the long march turns only to be a short protest. One thing is clear. Students are stepping forward, a sign of the country's widening crisis. We are getting ready. It's no matter what. It's time for students to show that the future generation has a voice, said Ashar Hussein, an engineering student at the Management Sciences School. We will not sit idle and do nothing while Pakistan is suffering. Student protests and campus unions are spreading across Pakistan. The students have blamed themselves for the past, having been disillusioned by a string of corrupt and repressive governments. But all of this bad stuff has happened, and we had gone numb. This will change now. And the article reflects a series of reports, actually, not only about the sudden radicalization that is affecting students across Pakistan, but also about the interjection of the worker struggles, even with representatives of the workers' movement, like the unemployed youth movement, appearing on campuses. Just one quick reference to a rather extraordinary statement that came out of a meeting between the unemployed youth movement and the students. The military dictatorship has shown its true colors, barbaric repression. Along with ruthless army oppression in different areas, it is capitalism that is destroying workers in this country. This war on terror is done on the dictates of imperialist masters. It is actually a war against workers in the form of downsizing, privatization, unemployment, profiteering. Army, capitalists, feudal landlords occupy land, industry, and economy. To carry on this exploitation, the army is directly involved in state power and politics. It wants to subjugate us all by tyranny and despotism. Whether through direct military rule or a paralyzed democracy in the clutches of capital, every ruler carries on this exploitation. This is extraordinary language to come out of a student movement and an unemployed youth movement in the light of the prior apparent passivity.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, A Revolutionary Crisis Opens in Pakistan. We have on the line with us from Islamabad, Pakistan, Maqsood Alan, BBC correspondent in Islamabad. Maqsood.
Yes, Maya.
There was a report that the one day before the emergency rule was imposed by General Musharraf, that there was a strike of engineers of the Pakistan International Airlines, the PIA, and that the strike led to the cancellation of 92 flights, local and international, and that all airports in the country were totally deserted. There was also a report that there was a major collapse in the stock market in Pakistan, an unheard of loss of billions of dollars. And this was taking place on the eve of martial law. Is there some connection between what was taking place in the country in terms of activism and rejection of privatization schemes and also the imposition of martial rule?
Well, I would not include what happened at PIA because this airline is besieged with problems for a number of years, and the routes are in because it's a government organization, and it's been shown over the years all over the world that governments cannot run organizations efficiently. So the organization itself, PIA, there are inherent problems, and a number of them. Among which corruption and inefficiency and mismanagement and just to name a few. So I won't include that. I won't connect what happened at PIA with what happened with Pakistan. But the second one that you mentioned was definitely the stock market crash. You see, markets, I mean, I'm no expert at markets. I know the very basics, which is they run on confidence. Markets and businesses run on confidence, on trust. If they know the political system of the country is stable, if they know in the future there will be a stable government, it could be a corrupt but stable government, the businesses will happily do the business. What has happened is that it's very it's come out very starkly that General Musharraf is a very weak ruler right now. And whatever step he takes, he just makes himself he just puts himself in more of a corner, really, and that has been reflected in the crash of Karachi Stock Exchange, because it's clear that whatever he's doing, he's actually running into more troubles, and with him, the whole country will go into trouble. Now, when I see around me, I have lost my basic. Well, I didn't have many rights in this country, really. Now I have lost those basic rights as well. I can be picked up, taken away. Without anyone telling any of my family members where are they taking me, why are they taking me, and how long will they keep me away, or if at all they're going to return me alive. No one has to tell anyone, really. And it's shocking. It's scary to live with this thought that no one has even the basic of rights. Now, why did this happen? War and terror, the spate of suicide bombings. Give me a break. Because the first thing you did was not strike at those suicide bombers and those so-called terrorists. The first two institutions you struck, one was judiciary, the other was media. So don't give me this. Don't tell me that you did this in the name of war on terror. You can sell it to President Bush. Yes, happily do that. But you can't sell it to your own countrymen. Because we saw what the purpose of all this action was. Number one, take away the judiciary because those judges were not listening to you. Those judges were being too independent. They had to be taken out. One, and media, well, there are laws. there are laws in this country. You can take media, any media organization, to court. Well, you did this defamation or whatever. There are laws to protect the governments, the organizations, individuals. The government has never taken any media organization to court. Never. Why? Because it's very clear how they want to do business. They want to do business by a sheer and naked show of power. All you need to do is to call up these cable operators and say, this is the government of Pakistan, pull out the wires on A, B, C, and D channels. They'll happily do it. That's it. This is how easy it is to pull the plug on any media organization. This is what they've done. So it's very clear. It's very clear what the purpose of this exercise was. General Musharraf was getting into a corner. He was afraid that the Supreme Court verdict is going to go against him, and therefore he hid behind the war on terror. He hid behind the spate of suicide bombings, and the markets at least saw this and they reacted, and that's how the huge losses in stock exchange occurred.
Apart from the question of the crisis in the economy in Pakistan, which is real and a reflection as well of the crisis in global markets and in U.S. capitalism itself, you have the increasing evidence that the Asia Times and that the Independent and the international news in Islamabad and in Pakistan have been articulating that, for example, with the attack on the Bhutto arrival rally where 140 to 150 people were killed, all of the elements of that attack were in the hands of the security forces of Musharraf. It's been reported with a great deal of specificity. So the category of terror, as invoked in Pakistan, as invoked everywhere, becomes a cover for operations that the security forces themselves very often are authoring. And
well, Benazir's husband, Mr. Zardari, he was the first one to say, and he could say that because he was living in Dubai, hasn't been to Pakistan, and he said that these blasts, the government agencies, the spy agencies were behind the blasts. And generally speaking, it's the overriding opinion, but there is a general understanding that a lot of what happens in the name of terrorism is actually controlled by some of these spy agencies within the government, and then they use them to their own purpose. It's like people in America believe that the CIA is behind a number of acts which can be categorized as terrorist acts. So it's the same kind of notions that exist in Pakistan, that the Pakistani spy agencies have been involved and are involved in controlling these elements, if not protecting them and spreading them.
That goes to the issue of what Benazir Bhutto had stated, that Musharraf's force should be directed against agents of instability, and she refers to those who are resisting U.S. occupation in Afghanistan and their support in Waziristan. She addresses the same issues that the Musharraf regime apparently addressed by talking about the necessity to fight against militancy. Militancy ascribed to those who resist U.S. policies, whether on an Islamic or other basis. So, in fact, we have here a demonstration that Benazir Bhutto and the Pakistan People's Party, as Washington had hoped, is designed to provide a patina or a fig leaf of legitimacy to arbitrary rule in Pakistan. But the reports that we have seen and the constant evidence as emerging from the radicalization affecting the campus and the disaffection affecting the Pakistani masses indicate that the population sees through it. The population is cynical about the political parties that purport to speak in their name. And indeed, the press is increasingly pessimistic about the ability of Washington to stabilize the Musharraf regime with or without Benazir Bhutto.
I'd like to look at some of the evolution because I was reading about the draconian labor laws in Pakistan and how union activity is banned, for instance, among railway workers. And there has been a privatization of national industries, such as in the banking and financial sectors, in education, in the electric supply. And along with this, there has been the firing, the sacking of tens of thousands of workers that leads to the atomization of the workers. There has also been the kidnapping as well as the arrest of labor leaders, and one of them, the trade union leader, Arif Shah, had been murdered, and that had led to the setting up of the Pakistan Trade Union Defense Campaign, which has been spearheading some of the defense of workers' rights. And when you keep atomizing the working class and you ban the establishments of union, which would lead to the organized protest, you're eliminating, in many ways, a sector of your resistance. Now you go further, banning student unions, as happened 20 years ago. You're also cutting off the dissent among another group that had been an important force, as you mentioned, in Pakistani resistance. So now what you have is recently with the civil society, the human rights activists, the media, and the lawyers, you are cutting them off from protests. They had been the one group that had at least some modicum of ability to protest. So this is what we see now is the backfiring of this step-by-step plan to eliminate any protest within Pakistan, and now it is backfiring.
Well, Maya, I believe, I'm afraid I am not too close to the right now what's happening with the labor leaders. But my understanding is that the one element in Pakistani society that welcomed General Musharraf wholeheartedly and actually propped him up for so long was the middle classes. The absolute poor, the downtrodden, the people whose main problem is putting bread on the table, they really, like we talked earlier, they really are not interested in politics. They don't care who's ruling them. If someone takes them to a polling station, they'll vote for whoever, but otherwise they are not politicized at all. The middle classes. These are the people, the professionals, the liberals. They actually hailed Jalal Musharraf because Nawaz Sharif was really an inept leader. He was really becoming too big for his boots, really. And Jalal Musharraf came as a neutralizing factor. Here is one man who can actually cut down this man to size, Nawaz Sharif to size. But then within 7 years, within eight years, Jalal Musharraf has lost each and every segment of society that supported him, one after the other after the other. What's left with him is only the people who have something to gain from him in the government. There are people in his government, ministers in his government, there are charges of corruption, charges of murder, arson, you name it. The most serious, most heinous crimes are these people around him have been charged, and they're still the investigations have been suspended against them, and they will remain suspended as long as they are with General Musharraf. So these are the people he has with him right now. Most other segments of the society have deserted him or are deserted him. And Maya, I'm sorry, but I've got to leave now.
All right. Well, Masood, thank you so much for being with us, and we'll hope to continue in this discussion. Take care. Good speaking with you. Thank you, Masood.
We had been speaking with Masood Alan, the BBC correspondent in Islamabad. Ralph?
Yes, Maya, I want to address a particular question here, which is the role of the working class and of the trade union movement. I had mentioned before the All Pakistan Trade Union Federation and the National Trade Union Center in Pakistan. There are 240 trade unions of the public and private sector associated with this. That represents not millions, but tens of millions of people in Pakistan. And as the All Pakistan Trade Union Federation stated, workers of Pakistan face the worst working conditions, long working hours, low wages, no freedom of association. There is no implementation of labor laws, no freedom of association, as the description of the PTDU, the All Pakistan Trade Union Federation, makes clear. By the same token, under the mask of arresting attorneys and lawyers and activists of the political parties, the real ongoing onslaught is against labor activists across the board. Everywhere where there are disappearances and torture, the first target are the labor activists. And one of the cover operations of the emergency law, which is purportedly addressed to the Pakistan People's Party or to the other large middle class parties, is that they do indeed. Tens of thousands are being taken off the streets in a generalized repression. But the disappearances are affecting trade union organizers and trade union activists, and they are not succeeding in cowing that working class. As the report by Random Pottens makes clear, the declaration of emergency represents a setback for George Bush, but it misses the point on what is really happening in Pakistan. And then the article proceeds to describe what I've just mentioned, the all-out assault upon the Pakistan trade union movement, upon the working class in Pakistan, and the generalized anger that it is engendering. The International Federation of Chemical Energy, Mine, and General Workers Union has issued a declaration demanding the release of all those who have been detained from their trade unions. The leaders of the trade unions most outspoken in Pakistan have been those who have disappeared. The PWLU represents 130,000 workers of the Pakistani Water and Development Authority. Union after union is being struck down. And while the press may focus on the lawyers and the students, and it's important that the student radicalization is noted, beneath that surface you have the generalized radicalization as well of the Pakistani working class. And that is why, brothers and sisters, Liaquat Ali Sahi and members of the APTUF, Farid Awan, the General Secretary of the All Pakistan Trade Unions Movement, is being tortured as he has been disappeared. This is the thrust of the repression, and this is why emergency rule is so important to not only the Bush administration, but to the large bourgeois parties who are being affected by it. But even as that will be reconciled and even as that will be resolved, under the cover of that resolution, that very power-sharing discussion, the behind-the-scenes contacts between the military and the large parties, underneath that cover continues the repression against working people,
Ralph,
and the resistance that flows from it.
Ralph, it should be noted that there has been a wholesale sell-off of the resources of Pakistan, the privatization of state-run and efficiently state-run industries, be it water, electricity, banking, financial sectors, and that along with the sell-off and the restriction, the banning of unionization in these in these employment sectors, that workers, for instance, the bank workers, were deprived of their political rights as well. And as was noted by Mr. Alon, the bourgeoisie accepted Musharraf because they saw in him somebody who could stabilize, who could militarily control and suppress the working class and their struggle against the privatization, their struggle for a better life for themselves. But now the attack is on the bourgeoisie itself. And because of the intense pressure and the strikes of the workers, the Supreme Court itself under Chaudhry was going to evaluate the privatization laws in Pakistan. And this Musharraf had to put a stop to.
Here is the statement of the chairperson of the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan, Asma Jahangir, in detention in Lahore since the imposition of emergency rule. The new law, she stated, to try offenses ranging from murder to libel is an expression of the government's own lack of confidence in its selected justices. Judges. The onslaught on the courts is not because they are supposedly obstructing the trial of terrorists, but because they give relief to those who are falsely accused. There is little doubt that the Musharraf regime will not change its course. They have support from Washington. They want absolute power. They will tolerate no dissent. And they use the terrorist card, she writes, to keep the international community at bay. How long will this bluff work, she asks. We refuse to be cowed down, even in detention. The wide powers to the military courts to try civilians is nothing but an expression of their will to suppress the population at large. It will fail. The population sees through it. The day of reckoning is drawing near. And that sentiment is deepening in the mass of the population, which is reason for the alarm that is increasingly apparent in the reports in the established press. The Washington Post account, Musharraf's survival hinges on elections, indicates that the very elections that they had counted on to stabilize the regime are now in jeopardy because so clear is the naked exercise of brute repression that the parties that were supposed to collude in the process cannot continue to retain their mass base unless they move into open opposition. And this, by the way, gives rise to a discussion of the article in the New York Times on November 11th, Maya, called The Coup at Home, by Frank Rich. And however the liberal framework of this article, it is extremely indicative. He writes, as General Pervez Musharraf arrests judges, lawyers, and human rights activists in Pakistan, our Senate was busy demonstrating its own civic mettle. Chuck Schumer and Dianne Feinstein, liberal Democrats from America's two most highly populated states, gave the thumbs up to Michael B. Mukasey, ensuring his confirmation as Attorney General. So what if the chief and law enforcement official states will not state that waterboarding is illegal? A state of emergency is a state of emergency. You're either willing to sacrifice principles to head off the next ticking bomb, or you're with the terrorists. Constitutional corners are cut in Washington in impressive synchronicity with General Musharraf's crackdown in Islamabad. In the days since the coup in Pakistan, almost universally condemned as the climactic death knell for Bush's foreign policy, it may be the epitome of White House hypocrisy and incompetence, but that's not exactly news. And Rich goes on to state, as in Pakistan, so in the United States, that every element of the emergency rule is in place in Washington, that all of the exigencies that give rise to arbitrary martial law in Pakistan obtain in the United States, that all of the major figures in both parties have embraced this scenario, that the Gonzales Justice Department did not merely round up independent-minded United States attorneys and toss them in prison, it purged them. And it goes on to describe what Mukasey has in mind. The front-runner, Rudy Giuliani, who is a close ally of Mukasey, who is one of the major fundraisers for Giuliani, the new attorney general, they have a proven record in extra-legal executive power grabs, Musharraf style. After 9/11, they tried to mount a coup, floating the idea, and he's speaking here now of Giuliani with Mukasey's support, that he would stay on as mayor in defiance of New York's term limit laws on the basis of the presumptive crisis initiated by the attacks of September 11th. It's a very straightforward, clear, surprising, in fact, for the normal liberal framework of Frank Rich.
Right. Frank Rich, noted liberal Democrat, comes out in this important article, his piece in the New York Times, saying, quote, "The executive branch has subverted the rule of law in often secretive increments. The results amounts to a quiet coup, ultimately more insidious than a blatant putsch like General Musharraf's," end quote.
And he goes on to state, "A new Washington Post ABC poll found that the Democratic-controlled Congress and Mr. Bush are roundly despised throughout the land. Only 24% of the American people believe that the country is on the right track and reject both the president and the Congress. That's almost as low as the United States' rock-bottom approval ratings in the latest Pew surveys of Pakistan. So it's 15%. And he says wrong track is a euphemism. We are a people in clinical depression. We know that the ideals that supposedly set our nation apart have been vandalized. We know that no matter which party they belong to, there will be no restoration anytime soon. As in Pakistan, so in the United States, the coup at home," said Frank Rich, "is well underway, brothers and sisters. We are in the presence of a revolutionary crisis in Pakistan, a people long submerged and subjugated and persecuted and oppressed is rising in the country of Pakistan, 160 million people. It is an echo, brothers and sisters, of what we will find unfolding within our own national frontiers. That's the struggle that lies ahead."
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, A Revolutionary Crisis Opens in Pakistan, will be on our website archive, www.takingaimradio.com. Please contact us at takingaim@pacbell.net. That's takingaim@pacbell.net. We'll be with you next week. Tiki tiki no bini ay, nuna ramato tiki na wado wow, tiki tiki no bini ay, tato.